Coming right up, it's Earth Watch. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Food Front Cooperative Grocery, specializing in foods from local and organic producers. Food Front is located in Northwest Portland at 24th and Northwest Thurman. For more information, the number there is 503-222-5658. This morning, Eduardo de Landeros Tierre speaks about Coca-Cola in India, and then Eduardo speaks with Dr. De La Sella about the Oregon coast. And in preparation for Eduardo's interviews, we're going to play a little bit of music from Putumayo. Stay tuned.
Good morning. Buenas tardes. This is Eduardo de Landeros Tierre. This morning I'm going to be speaking with Brian Hirsch from the Corporate Accountability International about your favorite drink, Coca-Cola, and Southern India. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Eduardo.
Let's backtrack a little bit, and let's tell the listeners what CAI is.
Sure. Corporate Accountability International is a membership organization that wages campaigns challenging irresponsible and dangerous corporate actions around the world. We got our start back in the late 70s, early 80s under the name InFact. A lot of people know us from our Nestle boycott when Nestle was really aggressively marketing infant formula that was linked to all kinds of health problems throughout the developing world. And then at the height of the nuclear weapons buildup under Ronald Reagan, we led a nuclear weapons campaign boycotting General Electric, which at the time was the lead producer and promoter of nuclear weapons, until they actually moved out of the nuclear weapons industry entirely. And then over the last 12 years, we've been working on a tobacco industry campaign, which just reached a major milestone this last year with the entry into force of the Global Tobacco Treaty, which is the world's first ever global public health treaty. And it sets some really important precedents for prioritizing people's health over trade and commercial interests and commercial agreements. And that's been a great opportunity for us to launch some new campaigns challenging other abusive industries, and was the beginning of our water industry campaign, which we talked to you guys about this time last year,
right.
Regarding Coca-Cola's abuses in India.
Okay, let's talk about Coca-Cola and what they are doing in India. And there's a couple towns that they are involved with, right?
Yeah. Coca-Cola drains water from some of the poorest communities in the world to sell as bottled water and soft drinks. And this is part of a much bigger problem of corporations contributing to global water shortage. And Coke gets away with these irresponsible and dangerous actions because of their tremendous political and economic clout. This time last year, last November, we were talking to you guys at KBOO about a march that was going on in India protesting Coca-Cola's bottling plant in Mediganj, where the water levels have dropped over 40 feet and left people without enough water to meet basic needs. A similar thing has happened in Pachimada in southern India, where wells have run dry, and it's had a really tremendous impact there. The update in southern India is that, and really the update across the country is that pressure continues to build, and the groups that we're working with in India are continuing to call for international solidarity, pressuring Coke to shut down its plants in Mediganj and Pachimada permanently. And this is part of a much bigger problem. It's not just a problem in India. Just like air, water is a precious resource that sustains all life on Earth, and today over 1 billion people around the world don't have access to safe water to drink. And problems of water shortage and scarcity loom even larger as a profit-driven industry increasingly controls our water supply. The bottled water industry, led by corporations like Coke, also Nestle and Pepsi, have sold us a bill of goods, even here in the United States, positioning bottled water as healthy, when in reality it threatens our health, it threatens our ecosystems, it costs thousands of times what tap water costs, it undermines local democratic control of a common resource. And people around the world are resisting the attempt by corporations to dictate who has water and who doesn't. Momentum is definitely building in India. We're joining these efforts by raising awareness among people in the U.S. of the dangerous reality behind the image of bottled water, pressuring these corporations that profit from it, and also actually working toward a global treaty that could protect the human right to water.
Okay, I'm sort of curious. The Coca-Cola plants operating in India, they are... tell me what they are, how they are taking the water, how they are processing that, and how that is affecting the local community there in them doing that. I'm sort of interested in the process and in what they are doing.
Yeah, we don't think about it when we go to the vending machine to buy a Coke, but all of the water that's going into soft drinks and bottled water comes from somewhere, and in India, Coca-Cola has gone into some communities where they're literally just draining the community's water. These are places where people have lived for generations and generations and have not had these kinds of problems, and all of a sudden they're seeing their water tables drop or their wells running dry. It's affected farmers' ability to irrigate their crops. It's affected the water quality. It's had a pretty broad range of environmental impacts. And they get away with it because of their political clout. In Plachimada, the most recent developments have been really from the village level all the way up to the Supreme Court. In April, the state high court of Kerala ruled that it made a ruling that could have helped to restart operations at a lower capacity in one of these communities that have been really seriously impacted. And then late in August, the Pollution Control Board in Kerala ordered Coke to keep their operations closed. This week, the health minister in Kerala went to Plachimada and pledged his support to the people there and to the efforts to challenge these abuses. And meanwhile, this case is making its way up to the Supreme Court in India. People at all different levels are involved, and the movement is definitely continuing to build pressure to get Coke to shut its plants down and pay back affected communities for the damages that they've done there.
Are these the only two bottling plants that Coca-Cola has in India, or are there more?
No, they have a number of plants.
Okay, and what's the status of the other plants? I mean, you have these two that are being challenged, but will these others keep operating and taking water, or what?
Last time we spoke with you guys at KBOO, there was a march going on in India while we were doing all kinds of grassroots organizing in the United States, collecting postcards and sending petitions to Coca-Cola about these practices. That march that was going on started in a city called Balia and marched 150 miles to Mediganj. Balia is a place where Coca-Cola had just opened up a brand new plant, And Medigange is one of these hotly contested plants that's been there for a few years, and they've really seen the impact. And I think that those two plants are symbolic of the, you know, the range of situations there. Koch has around 50 plants in India, and you know, some are new, some have been there for a while, some have created really serious environmental and health problems, and some are places where local communities are worried that it's you know, the same thing's going to happen to them that happened in Plachimada or Medigange. There are probably five communities that that I could, you know, speak to what's going on, where it's similar to Medigange and Plachimada in the amount of time that these kinds of things have been going on. But it's going on all over the country, and people really are concerned.
Coca-Cola, of course, has this massive image in the developing world. I mean, wherever you travel, you will probably encounter the logo, the Coca-Cola logo. And I know that is so in India, too. So Coke is literally in the psyche of the people, many people there. So how do you fight that, this corporate penetration?
That is a great question. I think that it's also a complicated issue to address. And I think that that's where the public education and you know, visibility work that we're doing, just exposing these abuses and challenging the image of the bottled water industry. It's not just in India, where, you know, where they have this very well marketed brand and brand loyalty that, you know, is seducing people to buy this product that it, you know, is creating some real harm to people around the world. Here in the United States, one out of two people drink bottled water, and one out of six people only drink bottled water. Despite the fact that bottled water is no safer, in fact, scientific studies have shown that bottled water is often less safe, sometimes with high concentrations of toxins like arsenic and mercury, and costs between 240 and 10,000 times the cost of tap water. You know, despite all of these things, one out of six people in the U.S. only drink bottled water. And it's because, you know, if you look at the most recent statistics available, in 2002, corporations like Nestle, Coke, and Pepsi spent $93.8 million portraying their products as pure, safe, clean, healthy, and superior to tap water. You know, we see the same thing going on, you know, in India, and but these corporations are misleading people about their products and about, you know, the fact that they are in fact not necessarily safe and not necessarily healthy for us, for our ecosystems. And so, you know, this is a big project. It's a campaign that has just gotten off the ground in the last year or so, and we're beginning by raising awareness among the U.S. public and exposing the dangerous reality behind this elaborately crafted image of bottled water and soft drinks.
Elaborate indeed. I guess Coca-Cola, then, all they are doing as far as India is concerned, then, is they're just taking the water and just put it in a bottle. I mean, they're not actually processing it, cleaning it, or going through any filters or what?
It depends. It depends on which plants we're talking about, and it depends on which products we're talking about. Dasani water, and actually a quarter of the bottled water that makes its way onto the shelf usually comes from municipal water system. You know, it comes from the tap, basically, with some minor treatments to it, nothing that makes real significant differences. In the UK, there was... people were pretty outraged when 500,000 bottles of Dasani water were actually recalled because they were found to contain bromate. So, you know, it depends on the place and the product, but across the board, it's a problem that we've encountered. In India, their soft drinks had pesticides in them.
Great.
So.
Okay, I guess we're sort of at the end. If people have more questions or want to take a more active role to fight your favorite Coca-Cola, what can people do?
There are a lot of ways to get involved. You can visit our website and take action online, www.stopcorporateabuse.org.
Once more?
Again, that's www.stopcorporateabuse.org. And there's more information online about our campaigns. You can take action online, send sign petitions and send messages directly to the CEOs of these corporations about their abuses. You can sign up to get a bottled water campaign action kit for your own community if you're involved in a church group or a community group where you could bring this campaign and take part. That would be fantastic. And you can also sign up and become a member. We're a membership organization. 95% of our funding comes from our members, and that's how we run our campaigns. Get online, and there's a lot of ways to get involved.
Great. And, of course, don't buy so much Coca-Cola.
Yeah, you can certainly do that, too.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brian, and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Thanks, Eduardo.
Now we're going to go on to my next guest this morning, Dr. Dominic A. De La Sala, and he's with an organization called the Conservation Biology Institute. Good morning, Dr. De La Sala. Are you there?
Yes, good morning, and I'm actually with the World Wildlife Fund, but I've been working with that institute on the report that we'll be talking about today.
Great. Well, let's backtrack. Let's talk about the institute and the agency that you are with for the listeners, and then we can talk about the new study on the federal roadless policy.
Sure.
So, go ahead.
Okay, I'm with the World Wildlife Fund, and it's the largest international conservation organization in the world. We focus on places that have global importance, and the place that we have identified in the U.S., we've identified about 5 or 6 places that are globally significant, and it includes our region, the region that your listeners are in, which is the coastal area of Oregon, Northern California, all the way up to Alaska. That area is part of the coastal temperate rainforest that has been identified as only one of 7 regions in the world that support coastal temperate rainforest and are absolutely important on a global scale.
Okay. This study, can you give a little, I want to still get a little bit more history and how it came about with the current administration.
Okay. Are you talking about the roadless report that we just submitted to Governor Kulongowski?
Yes.
Okay, great. Roadless areas have an esteemed interest in our nation's history on public lands conservation dating back to the 1970s when people expressed interest that the unabated building of roads and logging of forest that comes with road building was starting to have an effect on old-growth forest and salmon and endangered wildlife. And so the federal government at the time was directed by Congress to inventory the remaining areas that were at least 5,000 acres in size that have no roads in them because they are absolutely key in maintaining water quality and fish and old-growth forests. Well, the debate dragged on for about 2 decades, and then President Clinton in 2001 issued the Roadless Conservation Rule, which set aside 58.5 million acres of remaining roadless areas in the lower 48 and the Tongass National Forest in Alaska. These really are the crown jewel of our national forest and our public lands in the nation. Well, back in May of 2004, President Bush took away that rule and inserted an uncertain process where the state governments have to petition the federal government for those roadless area protections. And in the meantime, we're seeing logging projects springing up now in areas that were previously set aside on the Clinton roadless rule are now vulnerable to logging under the Bush administration's repeal of that rule, which is now kicking back the decision-making process to an uncertain petitioning that the state governments are taking a look at right now.
The harm that this is doing to the forest and to the land in the Northwest, and particularly the salmon recovery, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. What we found from our studies, and it's been confirmed by other researchers, is that the roadless areas are the strongholds for fish conservation. These are the areas that really support the most viable wild fish populations we have left in the Pacific Northwest. And they're key to the Oregon Salmon Plan. So if we are serious about conserving our wild fish populations and our drinking water supplies, we really need to have these anchor points, because when you build a series of roads into these forests, you change their character for good. And what you do when you build a road is that many times those roads will intersect streams, and that intersection of the road and the stream is a source of sediment delivery to the streams, which can definitely affect adversely salmon habitat. So we really need to have these roadless areas in place to protect our endangered wild salmon populations and our drinking water supplies. And I was listening to your last interview. It was real interesting to me because there's a crossover with what we found in our study, and the roadless areas actually in the state of Oregon supply about 500,000 acres of pristine, clean drinking water to the municipalities of the cities of Bend, Pendleton, and Ashland, Oregon, that derive their clean drinking water from those roadless watersheds.
I was thinking President Bush was able to push through this legislation that made possible this new this threat. How can people be made more aware of the harm that this is being done, and also the economic consequences of this? But I guess because the Bush administration is saying that this has to happen because it's good for the economy. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. It's interesting that the Bush administration is making an economic argument on this, but if we are to look at the long-term sustainability of our communities, it's going to come from a lot of different factors. I mean, timber will continue to be an important contributor to the regional economy, but we've got to start asking a question about how do we want to live in a sustainable society and a sustainable community. And if we go into the last remaining tracts of public roadless lands, we're going to be placing ourselves and our kids and their generation at risk of not being in a sustainable world. And it's also interesting that a number of studies have come out since the roadless rule of 2001 that were put out by economists that have shown that roadless areas, other protected places like national parks, national monuments, wilderness areas, they do have an economic value. And their economic value is serving as a magnet, if you will, of attracting new businesses to communities to help in rural diversification. And those businesses are coming with jobs, and they're relocating to our state based on its wild and scenic and its aesthetic qualities. That's why a lot of businesses are coming into Oregon, because they appreciate the same thing that we all appreciate, which is the quality of life and the aesthetic values that our lands provide. And so one has to question whether or not it's sustainable to go into the last 2 or 3% of roadless watersheds left in the nation to take out a small portion of timber that would not be a sustainable supply because of the loss of ecological values.
Okay. We have this roadless policy in place. What needs to happen? What can happen next? And what can we do now?
Well, Governor Ted Kulongowski has been a very strong supporter of roadless protections in the state of Oregon, and he has challenged the Bush administration's uncertain petition process. And the governor would like to see a streamlined version of that process so that governors that support roadless protections on federal lands can have a clear path to ensuring that those areas are set aside for the public value. And I think that the listeners can contact the governor's office and urge him to go forward with filing a full petition with the Bush administration as part of the different options that the Kulongowski folks are looking at for protecting federal roadless areas.
Okay. So is there a phone number or a website that people can get to?
I think you can just go to the state's website and contact their natural resource policy director in Governor Kulongowski's shop over at the state capitol.
Do you have any actions planned in the future, particularly in the Portland area, that people might want to go to or take part?
Nothing in the near future, but I'm usually up in the area giving lectures and talking to folks about the important values of roadless areas in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Dr. De La Sella, and you were very enlightening.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, this has been Eduardo de Landeros Tierra, and I just spoke with Dr. Dominic A. De La Sella with the Oregon Natural Resources Council and Conservation Biology Institute. And before that, I was speaking with CAI, Corporate Accountability International, and their struggle with Coca-Cola worldwide, but in particular, Southern India. Ciao, cuídate y paz.